You're listening to The Secrets of Doctor Who, episode number 17.
I'm a doctor. I've lived for over 2,000 years.
I have Scottish. I can complain about things.
Shush.
Hi, I'm Father Roderick, and welcome to a new episode of The Secrets of Doctor Who, the show where we discuss the latest episodes of the hit series Doctor Who. Of course,
so always The Secrets of Doctor Who, episode number 17. Today we are going to discuss two new episodes of Doctor Who.
Who is this guy?
I'm traveling in time. I remember that. I've been there before.
I think so, too. Yeah. There's this blue police box in my room. this voice came out. I don't know what's happening. I'm in some time vortex. Anyway, so as I was saying twice, this is the show where we talk about Doctor Who and the new episodes, time travel, and all that jazz. Joining me today, Father Corey, from somewhere in the middle of the United States. Remind me where you live.
Town of Malta, Montana. It's about 60 miles from the Canadian border.
Wow.
Feels good. Feels good to be back. I wasn't here last time because I was off on a trip or something. I can't remember where I was, but I was gone.
Probably some diocesan thing. It's usually
I think it was a diocesan meeting.
Also joining us all the way from San Diego, Jimmy Akin.
Howdy. How's it going, Father?
We're good. It's a beautiful autumn or fall here in the Netherlands, and it's the perfect weather. Everything is golden brown. And it's almost a shame to sit in front of the television watching TV because, well, but that's what we do. Otherwise, we have nothing to talk about. So today, another two-parter with two titles that clearly are related, The Girl Who Died, The Woman Who Lived. We're just going to go through both episodes chronologically and talk about the themes as we see fit. So let's start with The Girl Who Died. We are kicked straight into the middle of a pursuit. Apparently, the TARDIS is being pursued by aliens. At least I presume it is. And according to the Doctor, they've been going from one side of the universe to another. Clara is outside in a spacesuit. I think it's the same spacesuit that she wore on the moon, isn't it?
This is the one that keeps kind of showing up since David Tennant's time.
Yes,
the red suit with the yellow helmet.
I guess it's to pretend that this is a low-budget show. They're just using props over and over again. But Clara is not alone in that spacesuit because apparently, according to her, as she is saying in a panicked voice to via the intercom to the Doctor in the TARDIS, there is a bug creeping slowly up from her left leg all the way to her spine, and the Doctor reassures her that it's only a love spider? Who is going to suck her brains out and do all sorts of nasty stuff.
Because it's only hungry. It's only hungry. No big deal.
No big deal. And in the meantime, of course, the Doctor is trying to shake the aliens that pursue the TARDIS, which he ultimately manages to do right in time. And the TARDIS lands. They step out. This is kind of one of the funny things of this episode. It's full of like parodies of tropes, and so you escape one danger, and right away they are being arrested by other villains, and so they're in trouble again. Was there any reference to aliens that we've seen before in the pursuit? Is that an in joke? I didn't do much research on.
I don't recall.
I didn't really catch the names very well, so I don't know exactly which species they were.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's this is all still part of the prologue before the intro music and the logo, etc. But we already get some interesting quotes from the Doctor. Where he says to Clara, well, you know, I'm not the police. It's just what's said on the box. We just make ripples in time, but not waves. So he doesn't want to get involved. He doesn't want to disturb the timeline continuum. I guess the Doctor must have seen the Back to the Future trilogy as well. So he knows about the consequences of messing up the time-space continuum.
Parents disappear starting with their heads.
Yes.
Yeah.
You never know what could happen. And so but we find out later in the episode, of course, that this is a bit more profound. This has to do with the whole theme of you know, why is the Doctor here, and what can he do, and what should he do? And we see the end of the sonic sunglasses, or so I thought, because they get crushed.
We're all hoping.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the Vikings weren't too impressed by that advanced technology, that the human race won't have for 9 million years.
Yes.
They kind of just broke them.
And the Vikings are portrayed in the, again, almost as a cliche, with the horned helmets, which according to historians is not correct at all.
It's totally ridiculous. Nobody would go into battle with horns like that on their helmets. It just would make it easy to grab somebody's helmet, take it off, and then their head is defenseless.
Catch the sword on it and give them more force.
Exactly. There's just all kinds of problems. So, no, Vikings never wore horns on their helmets. That's an invention of 19th century opera. And allegedly, Stephen Moffat said that they just went with the horns because otherwise they'd have to explain it in the dialogue that they didn't really wear horns. And I'm going, big deal. You know, you can have Clara say, why aren't they wearing horns? And the Doctor says, real Vikings don't wear horns.
Yeah.
Done. You know, that's all you got to do. Mm-hmm. So I found the horns distracting and harmed suspension of disbelief.
Well, yeah. But then again, almost everything in Doctor Who forces you to suspend disbelief, and it's always hard.
So they're already asking a lot of us. We don't need the horns on top of it all.
And then in addition to that, the controversial sonic sunglasses, really. By the way, did you know that there has been a petition to get rid of those sunglasses? Fans hate them. Stephen Moffat was at the MCM London Comic Con, and according to an article from this past Sunday, he was actually questioned or asked about why the sonic screwdriver was out of the window or out of the TARDIS. And Moffat has hinted that the glasses may not be around that long after all. He said, I know that there's a petition to get rid of them. I think it's going to be a very successful petition. Of course, he's already written the entire season, probably.
Yeah.
But he says, I love the fact that people have risen up in anger. God knows how that lot would have got on when we introduced regeneration. So he's like, we have a very conservative audience. And then he went on to give an impassioned defense of the sunglasses, describing how every kid with glasses is now Doctor Who. Right.
It actually deflates it a little bit. I mean, if you're a kid, you want a fancy toy, not just an ordinary pair of sunglasses.
Exactly.
I was going to say, I mean, they look like just plain old sunglasses. I mean, you know, Ray-Bans or something like that. And there's no flash. There's no, you know, once in a while you hear a little chirp out of them, but that's about it. There's really nothing special to them.
Well, I think he's just playing with the audience. If you read the rest of his reply, it's like, kids whose parents don't want to shell out for a sonic screwdriver toy, they just put on a pair of sunglasses and they are Doctor Who. And best of all, every celebrity walking into a party with their shades on is now cosplaying Doctor Who, which is awesome.
Oh, there you go.
So if it pricks the pomposity of uber celebs and turns a defect into a superpower and confers star magic on an old pair of sunglasses, what could be more Doctor Who than that?
A sonic screwdriver.
Yeah. Well,
I almost wonder if it was something like Peter Capaldi says, you know, if I'm going to play guitar, I should have the shades too.
Probably. And then they just thought of, well, we could turn that into a tech device.
Exactly.
Also interesting, during that same Comic-Con, they asked Moffat to whether the Doctor could be played by a woman. And he said yes. And that the Master changing gender proved it was a possibility, but that there are currently no plans to get rid of Capaldi anytime soon. So I guess that's reassuring for Peter Capaldi.
Incidentally, since you raised the Doctor as a woman question, that's something that's been around ever since the Tom Baker days, because Baker when he indicated, when he talked about his own leaving, he referred to the man or woman who would play the Doctor next. And so that's been a recurring discussion ever since. And I'm not opposed to the idea of the Doctor being played by a woman necessarily, but it would be a big hurdle for the series, because thus far we've had 12 guys.
Yes.
And
yes,
making that big a change in the central character, even though it fits with the logic of the series, you know, apparently Time Lords are like black mollies, you know, fish that change their gender.
Mm-hmm.
It, after that long, it would just feel so different.
Yeah.
It would also create a different dynamic with the companions,
mm-hmm.
who thus far have typically been women. You'd either have a different dynamic with women companions, or you'd need to get male companions, which would also be a different dynamic. It seems to me that there's a huge amount of risk in making that adjustment. Lots of fans would hate it. And so the time to do it, if you were going to do it, would not be when the series is successful, but when it's plummeting in the ratings and it's either been canceled and you're coming back, or if it's about to be canceled, it could be a last gambit to get ratings.
Yes. And then they could always blame it on that change, that that was the end of Doctor Who. Well, we made this fatal mistake of changing him into a her. But we see the same discussion every time there's a new Bond movie, and apparently we currently have a new Bond movie, Spectre. And there's been the same discussion, especially in the UK press. So it was, why can't the next Bond be a woman? And there too, I mean, yeah, why not? I mean, after all, it's 007, could be anyone, but they're not likely to do that anytime soon because they have a winning formula, and why change it when more people than ever are going to watch the series?
And that's the argument. I think that's a key argument is, you know, they've got something that's working now. And I know that people say, well, for equality on this, but it's working.
Well,
why change something when it's working?
And it's not that the companions are damsels in distress, and they have very strong roles, and we've seen some very, very strong female roles. So it's not that Doctor Who is devoid of women. It's not like a super male thing. I think in that respect, James Bond is much more kind of a male series than Doctor Who has ever been. But anyway, we'll see. Speaking, by the way, of Moffat, Dom, who couldn't be here today, told me that he has said something about switching to specials instead of a series because he's going to be very busy with the Sherlock series, and he won't have time to write an entire season of TV. That sounds to me like a big risk to take too. If people don't have their weekly fix of Doctor Who, I mean, the series has been on for so many years.
They do without a weekly fix of Doctor Who for 9 months of the year.
True.
And they've done the specials thing before, where you in the final season of David Tennant, they didn't do a full season. They did four 90-minute specials, and so that was effectively the running time. I mean, I think they were 90 minutes, and if so, that would be the equivalent running time of 8 episodes.
Yeah.
So, that's most of a season. And if they're spread out so you don't get them all at once, then you get a nice fix every few months.
It could, there could be advantages to it, but also, I don't know if they can have that same exposure that they have right now with, you know, every week there's a lot of discussion online about what's going to happen next. And I don't know. Sounds risky to me. Plus, I don't know why Moffat has to be involved in each and every episode. I mean, they could have other writers as well.
This hooks into something that I wanted to talk about today anyway, because it's connected with this first episode, The Girl Who Died.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things a lot of people don't realize about the way television is made is that even though you see one person's name on the screen as the writer of the episode, typically, it's actually been gone over by the show producers. And so when you see something, even if it says Mark Gatiss as the author of the episode, really, Mark Gatiss wrote the first draft, and Stephen Moffat and other potential people like script editors have been over it and rewritten it.
Yeah.
And so the showrunner, like Stephen Moffat, is actually involved in writing every episode. He just doesn't normally get credit. I'm not exactly sure how the rules work in England, but here in the United States, in order to get a writing credit, you have to contribute in a very substantial way, because it's expected that the producer is going to be doing rewriting. Yeah. That was the case with Star Trek, for example. Gene Roddenberry and other people on staff like DC Fontana and Gene Kuhn all took passes on those original Star Trek scripts to punch them up and improve them. Yeah. But they only would get a writing credit if they made major changes. Mm-hmm. And for that, they had to go to the Screenwriters Guild and say, look, here's what we did. Here's why it went beyond what a producer would normally do, and that's why I deserve a writing credit.
Right.
So this episode, The Girl Who Died, has a co-writing credit for Stephen Moffat, and that's very unusual. I went back on Wikipedia and looked, and there are very few other instances where of the current incarnation or the current series of Doctor Who, all the way back to 2005, there are very few instances where there's a co-writing credit. And Stephen Moffat has previously talked about how he wasn't particularly anxious to have outside writers like Neil Gaiman write, who aren't television writers, because you have to do even more work on their to make their scripts usable than normal. And so this one with the co-writing credit suggests that he did major rewriting on it. He didn't just write that scene at the end about why the doctor has his face. It's something bigger than that. And usually when you have that kind of rewriting, it's a signal that there was something seriously wrong with the original script. And so the producer comes in as a script doctor. And that's my guess about what happened with the Girl Who Died. It's an unusually silly episode, even for Stephen Moffat. And as soon as I saw, even before it aired, that Stephen Moffat had a writing credit on it with somebody else, I said, I bet this one's going to be substandard. And I have to say, I thought it was.
Interesting. I was intrigued by this episode because it seemed to me like an imbalance between – there was a lot of humor in it, also in the Woman Who Lived, but most of all in this one, The Girl Who Died, some almost like stand-up comedic pieces, which was kind of refreshing in a way. It was some very funny jokes, but felt a little bit out of character for the Doctor. And then you had these – super serious fundamental themes about death and immortality, and which to me very clearly showed the mark of Stephen Moffat. It's stuff that he's already brought up in previous seasons as well. So, but the whole thing, yeah, I agree. It felt a little bit wacky, out of place, strange.
Kludged together in a way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The whole scene with the fighting where they're trying to learn how to fight, you know, and the whole village is on fire because of it. It was just kind of that's like an old camp scene.
I know.
That's an old campy scene.
But I enjoyed that because that felt like they were just making fun of tropes. And we'll get to that. Another thing that really distracted me, even though I think she did a great job, was the fact that we had a Shieldir, the girl played by Maisie Williams, who is so recognizable from Game of Thrones. And she immediately took me out of the episode because, well, she's the girl from Game of Thrones. And it became even a bit disturbing at one point because they were talking about her as if she was a young woman. Whereas in Game of Thrones, she's a child, you know, and it was a bit of innuendo there. I was like, that feels wrong. It feels just off key. And I don't know. Perhaps it's just me, but...
I've never seen Game of Thrones, so
yeah, you don't have that problem
there. So,
but it just—I don't know. But she did a good job, I think, trying to make the most out of her role. But I did, again, I also didn't feel that her dialogue was all that well written.
See, I felt more comfortable with her as a character in the second episode than I did in the first.
Interesting. Whereas I thought the character that she plays in the first episode is much more like the character she plays in Game of Thrones. Mm. And the second one felt forced to me and almost too like she's playing a character that's supposed to be older than she actually is, the actress actually is.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway.
Well, about 800 years older than the actress actually
is.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. So we learned that the Doctor and Shieldir cross eyes and the Doctor is disturbed and he has this premonition which he defines as remembering in the wrong direction. I actually like that. It's a typical Doctor thing to say. And then, of course, we got the impersonation of Odin, which was a bit lame. And then the appearance of this projection in the sky of Odin's face and the robots being teleported. And they are apparently going to harvest the fighters to extract hormones and all sorts of energy from them. So
I like how the people who were left behind said that they took half the village and the best half.
Yeah. That's a humble thing to say. How did you like the look of the robots?
They looked to me a lot like – I don't know that they were robots. I mean, didn't they have fish heads under there?
Yeah.
It was kind of a combination of the –
an armor.
Yeah. I thought they looked lumpy and something like a children's toy.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't look scary to me.
I think they were trying to be kind of like a tank armor, and it didn't really kind of come across either as, you know, that great.
To me, again, it felt like a trope. Like, this is what, like, bad B sci-fi movies, this is how they portray robots from other planets, and it's just a bit crazy and over the top.
Their armor was shaped almost like the Jadoon, which was that rhinoceros warrior race that we've seen before on Doctor Who.
Indeed. Yeah. I don't know if that was on purpose or not. And then we get another, I think, trope. The better half of the village is transported inside a spaceship. We never see the outside. We see that there is a corridor that leads to an escape door, but the one warrior that enters it is blasted into oblivion. It's a thing that we've seen a thousand times in many science fiction movies. And then the wall behind them starts moving, and I'm thinking, trash compactor scene, Star Wars.
Yes, exactly.
This must be timed. They must have known that the world is going crazy over Star Wars, so let's put in a moving wall. And then for some reason, Clara and Ashildir know to get to the other, or manage to get to the other side without being vaporized, so I don't know how that works.
it kind of shows it. Well, Clara grabs her and runs through the other door, and then the pirate guy recognizes the half of the sonic shades as advanced technology.
Right.
The Odin impersonator.
Yes.
The other Odin impersonator.
Fake.
By
fake
the way,
Odin.
Father, I couldn't help but thinking of a Star Wars reference as soon as the Doctor started imitating Odin. I immediately thought, well, I guess it's not against his programming to impersonate a deity.
Good one. Yes. Oh, boy.
I like how they then start referring to him as False Odin.
Yes. I'm False. Of course I'm a False Odin.
Yep. And incidentally, when he's proving his divinity by using a yo-yo, that's actually a callback to the Tom Baker era where the Doctor impressed his primitive sidekick Lala using Leela. Uh-huh. I'm sorry, Lala Ward was someone else.
Yeah.
But impressed tried to impress Leela using a yo-yo.
It didn't work too well.
Probably failed
either.
Back then.
Yeah. And you know, when I saw that pirate guy, speaking of Tom Baker, I was reminded of the pirate from Pirate Planet, the Time series, very similar character.
Yeah, but this one didn't have a mechanical parrot that killed people.
No, he just had robots that did it. Robot human or robot beings that did
it. I liked the next thing that when the Doctor explains, you know, of course I'm a false god, and so is that other Odin, because what is the one thing that gods never do? They never show up. I'm thinking, that's probably a line that Stephen Moffat included.
Oh, yeah.
He's been reading Waiting for Godot.
Yeah, probably. And then, the other indication that this is a false god is that he needs to drink this adrenaline testosterone extract, which totally grossed me out, if you think where it's coming from. So God is a farmer. Again, kind of a funny line was, you're just simple farmers and fishermen, web designers. Well, wait, not perhaps not web designers. There were a lot of jokes like that in this episode.
Little one-liners like that, yeah.
Yeah. What are you going to do against the Meyer? Raise crops against them? And then you've got the Viking. Yeah, of course, we will.
I liked the fact that they really hung a lantern on the indefensibility of these people, where the doctor just tells them the most sensible thing to do. Just leave. Get out of here. You know, don't be here when they come back. Yeah. That's the totally sensible thing to do. And even though they've pointed that out to the audience and had the doctor tragically translate the baby's wailings, the let's all, we're Vikings, we're going to defend our place is just, it was over the top for me.
It was, but I think it was done on purpose to underscore the fact that the doctor is, you know, walks away from these situations too often, perhaps. He doesn't want to fight. He's sick of fighting. You know, I'm willing to lose any war. So perhaps that's the contrast that they want to show.
I think they were suggesting that, but when does he actually do that? I mean, he walks away from situations after he's defeated the enemy, but when has he ever actually just walked away from an enemy? I mean, maybe once or twice, but it's not his habit.
I know, but it seemed to be the theme that they wanted to put in this episode, or that he walks away from a Shieldir later, and he is the one who gives up on his heroic role, something like that. And yeah, it felt a bit contrived because we know the Doctor is someone who always steps in and saves the day. Otherwise, he wouldn't be the Doctor. Well,
I think it kind of felt like he's struggling with his conscience, if you will, that he wants to just walk away, just get away, don't fight, don't just go, you know, get back in the TARDIS and go to a planet somewhere where the sun is always shining and there's a beach and it's warm and comfortable.
Oh, space Florida.
Yeah, exactly.
Without the alligators,
you know.
Yeah,
but
they've had space Florida before.
Yeah, but it's he doesn't do it. His conscience always nags at him, and
he can't. He cares.
Sticks around for the fight.
He cares, and that's the kind of the theme of what worries him so much about Isildur is that she stops caring at one point, and he wonders if she has if there's still good in her, but it's the same question that he probably has about himself, you know. Do I still have it to save the day one more time? Do I still care? But we're not there yet. I like the fact that the doctor, he speaks baby, says Clara reassuringly. and babies apparently speak in poetry and in beautiful literary phrases.
Well, one thing I liked is they didn't use it quite as campy as they did with the
Stormageddon.
Stormageddon, yeah. It was used as a laugh. Mm-hmm. You know, it was used as a joke. This was actually used as a serious plot point.
And fire in the water. I was thinking electric eels immediately. I don't know if that happened to other people as well, but yeah, thinking, oh, sure.
I didn't catch it, admittedly, either. No.
Okay, since we brought up the electric eels, here's the deal. Eels are a big thing in England. They have eels in England. They even eat eels in England.
Yes, we
one
do
of
too.
The famous British dishes is jellied eels. So eels are definitely a familiar cultural thing in England. But here's the thing. There are no electric eels in England or Europe. They're from South America.
That's true.
And so no Viking village would have electric eels in the 5th century in any way. So
unless they've been to those parts of the world and we just don't know that they did.
Yeah, or aliens opened a wormhole to South America, or Doctor Who, there's all kinds of possible explanations.
Good point.
If you know about electric eels, then this is another thing that'll pop you out of the story.
Yeah. Goes into the category of horned helmets.
Yeah. Also, electric eels do not make blue sparkly lightning bolts when they use their electricity.
No, that's true. But then again, it would be kind of boring
cool
if they didn't.
Did.
Yeah. Especially on demand like that, where he could just summon them to do it, you know.
Kick the bucket and they'll generate electricity. But
by the way, I was reading a story this week about a new study of electric eels that I guess just came out, which was really fascinating because it turns out the electric eels use their electricity not only to stun their prey so that they can, so the prey is immobilized and they can then eat it. They also use it to detect where the prey is, and they have a kind of electrical equivalent of a bat's sonar. And so when they send out these electrical impulses, they interact with the nervous systems of their prey, and they are simultaneously using it as a weapon and a tracking system, which is really cool.
It is.
Well, they don't want to get eaten.
And they want to eat.
That, some people are grossed out by that, but eels, we eat them in the Netherlands as well. It's actually quite a delicacy.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I'm thoroughly grossed out by that. But I'll have to tell you sometime about fish tacos, one of the delicacies of Southern California.
Mm, okay.
Surprisingly good. Fish burritos are even better.
I wouldn't mind fish tacos. Why not? Fish is good. Tacos are good. Combine them.
Next time you're over in the States, we'll have to find you some.
It's like custard and fish fingers. I actually tried that out, and it was your fault, Jamie.
Yes, and it was.
It was surprisingly good. It was surprisingly good.
I've meant to do it. I just haven't figured out a way to do it low carb yet. I'm sure I could if I put my mind to it.
It's true. There are carbs, of course, into crust around the
– Oh, yes.
And the custard.
Yeah. But can't you just like make an exception just for the doctor's sake?
No.
Okay. I won't mention it again. Let's go back to the Viking village, because there's this scene where the doctor is going to prepare them like any hero does in any kind of trope situation. He's going to build that army and he will train them, and he's going to give them another name, and he doesn't care what their names are called. I've seen this in so many other shows and movies, but I thought the names were funny. Like, you're like, he looks at the beard and like, ZZ Top.
And I love then, that like,
Heidi.
Yeah, that guy didn't have the longest beard. So,
no.
Yeah. But I like, though, when the guy who had the braids, he names him Heidi.
Yes. And of course, the Vikings don't get it, but they'll have to wait a couple more centuries in order to get that. But of course, everything goes wrong, and it was a bit jarring at first, like, what happened? And then they explain, well, just like, we've got Heidi is afraid of blood and faints, and then creates this chain reaction of I would have actually have liked to see the chain reaction, but probably that would go over budget.
Big time.
And then we get this recurring question: does the doctor actually have a plan? That seems to be Clara's big question mark. You keep telling me time and again that you have a plan. You do have a plan, right? Yeah, of course I have a plan. But ultimately, we learn that the doctor is only saying that to reassure Clara, because he wants her to feel safe. But does he really have a plan? Is he able to, to save Clara or not? Or is ultimately all that going away and he will be the last man standing?
And this is again kind of a recurring theme this season of, like, you think of with the master of what the Missy, how, the doctor always finds a way out because he knows there's one there. He knows there's a way out. And same kind of thing of, he comes up with the plan, but it's always right at the last minute. So find it.
Yeah. We see that Clara has unrelenting faith in the doctor. He is, after all, her hobby, we learn in this episode.
Yeah.
And the doctor is like, well, find another hobby. Again, it's this. He doesn't want to get too attached, and that seems to be the big theme. And of course, it's leading up to the fact that we're going to say goodbye to Clara in this season. He doesn't want to get too attached because it would hurt. We see that he is, Clara is growing on him, clearly on this version of the Doctor. A Shieldier, we have that kind of awkward scene. I thought it was a bit written in a clumsy way, where she has created this puppet or this wooden thing to pretend that will have an impact on the outcome of the battle and it will keep people safe. Of course, I guess that's a setup for the puppet that will actually save them, the dragon puppet. And then you get that awkward dialogue where she says that she's different, she's strange, but, here I'm loved. And I've always been kind of like I've not been myself, but here I am. And then later on, she loses her identity. She loses that confidence in the good that is in her. But I just felt that the whole conversation was a bit out of place and a bit weird.
Yeah, I thought the I'm different and don't fit in, but I found a home is like, okay, that's fan service. That's just writing to resonate and please the fans. It's not really realistic writing. Also, I thought there was author interest in this episode as well. Author interest being a type of writing where the author is speaking for himself, in a way that's kind of artificial, because guess who it is that saves the village? It's the storyteller.
Yeah.
And we get this stuff about storytelling and the power of storytelling. And it's like, yes, thank you, Stephen Moffat. We all know you're a storyteller.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And it definitely did feel like a scene that was just kind of put into, okay, we're going to go from this point to this point, and here's how we're going to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, and it goes very quickly into the resolution of the whole conflict, and it made me feel like, well, this episode could just be a standalone episode. It's well, they win, of
except
course,
for
they
the end.
Yeah, except for the end, but it almost felt like tacked on. Like we need to have a cliffhanger, so let's do this. And we've hired the actress for two episodes, so we'd better give her. Actually, she's going to be in another episode as well. So they conjure up this hologram using the technology of the false Odin, and then I kind of like the line where the Doctor is using some Star Trek-y techno babble, and like I'm inverting the flux whatever, and then
reverse the polarity,
of the neutron flow, and that's a line that goes all the way back to the third Doctor, John Pertwee.
Oh, really?
And it's been used over and over in the show.
Good.
It's been the subject of a lot of criticism because some people have said, "Well, wait a minute. I mean, neutrons are neutral; they don't have a charged polarity.
Ah.
So how would you reverse it?" On the other hand, some people have tried defending it, saying even though they don't have the usual kind of charged polarity like electrons and protons, they do have something equivalent, so you could technically do that. And in this episode, the Doctor, I forget exactly what he says after he uses the line, but he says something about the line that's kind of dismissive, suggesting to him that it's just something that he throws in.
He says, I'm sure that means something. I don't know why.
Yeah, sounds great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, it works, you know, but whatever he said, it does work. And so False Odin is scared to death because of that monster. And Clara has instructed one of the Vikings to record it with her phone. I don't know why she didn't do it herself, but well, anyway.
She wants to be in the action.
Say again?
Exactly.
Wants to be in the action. She doesn't want to be the wallflower taking pictures.
I guess so. So, but anyway, and then they threaten False Odin to upload that to the intergalactic YouTube equivalent, and that would be the end of his prestige in the international intergalactic villain community.
which actually, for honor culture and for someone who wants to, you know, have Viking smoothies. That would actually be one of the worst things that could happen, would be to lose face in front of your fellow evil people that way.
Apparently.
So it felt oddly modern, but actually I thought it was oddly believable in a way.
It's a bit like the worst thing that could happen to Klingon as well.
You
lose your honor, you lose everything. It's, you know, you die, basically.
Especially with the Benny Hill theme added to it.
Yeah. Is that a thing in the United States as well? Because Benny Hill is very, very famous here in...
it's from the UK, but so it's known here in the States, though. I mean, it aired in the States quite a bit.
It's not as big here, but yeah, people who watch British television will know about it. By the way, one thing, speaking of British things, when they come in, when the Meyer, I guess they're called, arrive in the barn, the remaining villagers are having a party, and they're doing something that, to me, looks like English country dance.
Huh.
And I call English country dances, and so I was like English country dancing two nights ago, and that to me looks like English country dancing. So
funny.
Why they're doing it in Scandinavia, I'm not entirely sure. Perhaps Clara and the Doctor taught them how to English country dance, since that's what they knew from England.
Why not? Perhaps they gave up on the fighting training and just switched to line dancing. Why not? But it was funny. It was a kind of this contrast of the villain who arrives with his big army there and is like, well, but let's have a fight. No, just join the party. Yeah, right. But again, the way in which they defeat the monsters in the harnesses, it feels a bit like a trope, like including like the anvils that are suspended in thin air and then they come down. It reminded me of the second Back to the Future movie where Marty McFly does that to defeat the bad guys who are trying to attack his former self, who is performing on stage. Remember that? And he is on the stage and he cuts the rope with the counterweights. And that's how he defeats him. Anyway, I thought it might have been a Back to the Future reference, which, by the way, of course, it was, last week was Back to the Future week. We are now officially in the future and still don't have a hoverboard, which is very disappointing. But the story's not over yet, because apparently the technology used a Shieldier as a battery, and now she's depleted and she's dead. And the doctor knew that that was going to happen. At least it seems that that he knew. But there is a Deus Ex Machina. There is a solution, because the doctor happens to have a small piece of technology that he can just place on her forehead. It disappears in her brain, and it's technology like nanotech. It will keep repairing a Shieldier time and again.
I think he said it was a med kit from the helmets themselves. Because you see, there's the scene where he's tearing apart the helmet.
Okay.
And there were two of the helmets that had gotten sucked up by the electromagnetic anvils. And it was med kits that from there that he had converted.
Okay. That explains it. Because I was like, why haven't we seen this before? It seemed like a pretty vital thing to have.
Yeah, it, like I said, because you see that scene, and they always, I love it when they do the scenes where they're pulling, technology from the helmets. It always looks like, a regular circuit board you see from, modern day. Yeah. Like they have circuit boards like we're familiar with. But yeah, you saw him tearing through, then you hear the sonic, screwdriver, but sonic shades do their little whir thing, and then he plugs it in to her head, basically.
Interesting. So
now the scene before that, though, where he kind of has his decision to help her, you can tell that was definitely a Stephen Moffat thing, because he's tying back to the first episode of Capaldi, the regeneration episode where he talks about his face. I think that was an important distinction they made, where it was the remembrance of him and Donna, and Donna saying, you don't have to save the whole village, just save one person.
But let me interrupt you. Is that in this episode, or is the remembering, why did I choose this face? Isn't that in the second episode?
No, that's in this episode, because he was looking in the eel's barrel.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
And he saw his reflection, and he goes, now I know why I chose this face.
Okay.
But it was a reminder of Donna telling him in the David Tennant regeneration, you don't have to save the whole village, just save one person. He ends up saving that Roman official.
And we knew that that was coming, because, of course, Peter Capaldi had that role without knowing that he would one day be the next doctor.
Exactly.
And Stephen had announced it. And we will kind of tie that in. And this is when it happened. I was just like, wow, that is kind of a very quick reference to something that is actually pretty cool. I wish they had taken some more time to explain the reference, or to just play a part of that episode very briefly and just remind us of that. But I appreciate it that they tried to tie it in.
Yeah, well, that was something I think people have been waiting for, fans have been waiting for throughout the series, was, okay, how are they going to pull this in? Because it was foreshadowed, again, from last season, Capaldi started.
Yeah.
How are we going to do this?
Mm-hmm.
And they finally got it.
So Shieldier is a hybrid now. And there's this whole conversation between Clara and the doctor, which actually I thought was well written. Might have been Stephen Moffat, but it was all about, it starts with this, the doctor not saying anything. And then Clara is like, you know, silence is even worse with a Scottish accent. I thought that was great. And then immortality is not living forever yourself. It's everyone else dying. And I thought that was a very kind of Tolkien-esque way to define immortality. Because isn't that one of the great things in The Lord of the Rings is this whole theme of the immortality of the elves. And it's similar to this kind of immortality. It doesn't mean that they're invincible or that they will regenerate when they get killed. No, if they are careful, they can live forever. But it's more a curse than a blessing because everyone else around you will be dying and you'll be still around and you will, there's nothing that subsides. And I remember when I was in seminary in philosophy, when I was still studying philosophy at the University of Louvain, that was actually one of the themes that we talked about at one point. Like, why is immortality on this earth, in this human condition, not something to strive for? Why is immortality only, why does it only make sense if it is living with God and being completely fulfilled, filled with his love? Because, well, it was the same thing. If you live forever on this planet, it's going to be a curse. It's going to be terrible because it's only saying goodbye. By the way, welcome back. Jimmy left the TARDIS for some strange your sonic screwdriver malfunctioned. But we're glad to have you back. What did you think about the whole immortality discussion between Clara and the Doctor at the end of the episode?
I thought it was interesting. I particularly liked the way they visualized it at the end for Ishildur, where she's standing there against the landscape and we have this kind of panoramic sweep around her as we see the sun and the moon whirling in the sky to suggest the passage of time. And we watch her expression change from something wondrous to something very much more grim.
Yes,
and I thought that was, even though it's kind of an iconic thing that doesn't really correspond to any moment in real time in the story, that it's very evocative and a nice setup for where we're going in the next episode.
Yes, and I think it kind of like summarized what the titles of these two episodes wanted to say. It's the death of a girl, and it's the woman who lives, but it's. Someone, the child in her had died. I think that's what they tried to convey here. Which brings us to the second episode, The Woman Who Lived, where it's a totally different world, a different time. There's a robbery. There's a monster lurking in the shadows of, again, another trope. We've seen that in Harry Potter and many other bad movies. Not that Harry Potter is a bad movie, but we've seen the glowing eyes and everything. The Doctor apparently has a kind of a scanner for strange contraptions, and it works in the same way as the scanner in the Aliens movie, you know, like beep, 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 we're getting closer.
Again.
The Curio scanner. And then we discover that Ishildur is now a robber, and she's able to change her voice. Apparently, she's had centuries to practice that. It felt a little bit, again, a bit weird, a bit off. But she is immortal, not indestructible. Since she has lived so many centuries, she has time to learn any skill, and her immune system is learning as well. The only thing that hasn't evolved and seems to be kind of constrained is her memory. And so she's writing down everything in diaries, but she regularly has to delete the hard drive in order to keep remembering new stuff.
Well, there was kind of a parallel here. Matter of fact, the whole episode really was a parallel between Ishildur / me and the Doctor.
Yeah.
And because in the first episode, you see the Doctor pulling out his 2,000-year diary and, you know, flipping through. Oh, yeah, I remember these people now. They were that, you know, he couldn't remember who they were until he went through his diary and said, oh, yeah, I've seen them before.
Uh-huh.
And she's doing that as well. She's diarying her 800 years that she's been on Earth.
Yeah, yeah.
Apparently in a lot more depth because she's got volumes and volumes and he's got one.
Exactly.
She's quite the writer, yes. And the Doctor goes through a number of these events in history and reveals that actually the Big Fire of London was started by aliens, the Pteroleptils.
That's a fifth Doctor episode in the Peter
Davison.
Oh,
that's what I figured. That must be a reference to an earlier episode.
One thing that I wasn't sure about that I don't think is from the show, but and I don't know if there's a way to pin it down, but Ashildur says that she, or indicates that she was like a medieval queen.
Oh, yeah.
And it was all, I forget what she said, it was like all backgammon and paperwork mm-hmm. or something. And so it wasn't a lot of fun, and she ended up faking her own death. And yeah. they show us a brief image of that, and I wish I knew British history or European history well enough to figure out, is she meant to be someone specific or not? But unfortunately, I don't.
Probably. I'm just typing in paperwork and backgammon and queen and Doctor Who, but apparently the internet doesn't know either.
Yeah, I checked on it too on some sites and wasn't able to find anything. So she may or may not be someone specific, but I wish I could figure out if she is.
Yeah, I will. Perhaps it's something that Stephen Moffat will reveal in the director's commentary or something like that.
Or somebody listening will go, oh yeah, you don't know about XYZ Queen? And, yeah. You know, she's mm-hmm. famous in my little corner of the world.
but she is, of course, very unhappy. The life like that has been hell. She wants to leave with the doctor. She wants to escape her condition, her existence. She's bored. She has suffered so much. Her babies died. She tore out other pages in order not to remember them anymore. And then on the other hand, we learn that she's actually fooling the doctor. She wants to acquire that artifact, that stone, for that cat-like monster. So she's kind of betting on two horses, it felt. Like, mm-hmm. if the doctor doesn't take me with him, I can always go with the lion guy.
Well, there's kind of a sense, and she kind of hints about, you know, I'm very clever, I figured it out. But there's kind of a sense that she's been trying to find him. She's been following him. She's been following traces of him, you know, and, oh, you always leave.
Yeah.
You know, how do you know that? I just figured it out.
Well,
and it's kind of more in the sense that she's following hints and rumors of him throughout history.
And he reveals that he has actually been following her and that he never stepped in to, you know, meet her again. So, well, yeah, he kept his distance as well. And she resents him for it.
I wondered if the way I initially took those lines is about I just figured it out and stuff is that she had a secret source of information who was the Lion Man. And I assumed the Lion Man knew more about the Doctor and had been telling her about him. But I guess it could be read both ways. Incidentally, with the cute young girl and the Lion Man theme, it seems like we've got a Beauty and the Beast.
Yes. Oh, very much. Even visually. I mean, there was this television series that was called, like, I think The Beauty and the Beast.
And with Ron Perlman.
Yeah. And the makeup was very similar to this.
And Disney's Beauty and the Beast looked a lot.
Also,
the Beast looked a lot like him.
Yes.
Yeah. So it was perhaps they're courting Disney to buy them out or something like that.
Well, I was going to say her dress was very Snow White. Ish too, yeah. That kind of dress, you know.
Mm-hmm. And of course, he's called Leandro, and they're playing with the lion. What was
lion.
It?
Yeah.
Oh
yeah, Leandro, Lion Man.
Yeah, it's quite obvious, quite over the top.
And Delta Leonis, I think. Yeah, Delta Leonis was the name of the planet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the canine ones have to come from Sirius, the dog star.
Of course, of course.
Exactly.
And then there's this whole kind of it's a little bit it's emphasized a bit too much, not very subtle, but oh, you wear a mask, but that is just, you know, your lack of sensitivity is like the mask you're wearing. And she, well, you know, this might be the real me, and that's perhaps what you fear. So and she's called, I think, Lady Me. That's how she called herself. So she denies being the girl because the girl, the child died in her. She's become jaded. But it all felt a little bit, yeah, I get the message. I know what you're trying to convey. But it was repeated over and over again in this episode.
Yeah, she's lost her identity. She's lost who she was.
Yeah, and so well, and apparently has a doctor.
She's lost all of her identities. Now she's just a pronoun.
Yeah. Yeah. Just me.
With a wealthy estate and a mask and a lust for adventure.
So she just wants to get out and doesn't really matter where. I'm thinking
– Father Roderick, girls just want to have fun.
Apparently. Cue in the music.
Cindy Lauper told us that back in the 80s.
Don't remind me of that, please. Now I need to somehow erase that from my memory. I'll write that down in my diary. Perhaps I'll forget about it.
Yeah.
The sonic glasses have been repaired. Boo-hoo.
Yeah.
I think we kind of figured that was going to happen.
I was hoping it wasn't. I was hoping we'd seen the last of them. But
yeah,
I guess we're going to be stuck with them at least until the Christmas special because all that's already been written and filmed. So
yes.
They probably won't be getting rid of them again that soon.
But they will.
Having brought them back from being broken just an episode ago, and we've only got like 6 or 7 episodes to go before Christmas, we'll probably be stuck with them till then. But hopefully they'll just vanish from next year's series and not be mentioned.
Who knows? By the way, some people think that the medieval queen that she's referring to might actually be a hint for a story that's still going to be told. Because we know the actress is going to come back. So perhaps it might be something for the future.
That would be cool.
Yeah, and I think I also read something about a hint that we missed in our previous in the discussion of the previous two episodes
about the war leader,
perhaps potentially
that one is they mention when they go to the Scottish village in 1980 in before the flood, the woman from the future is talking to the doctor about how we're now before all of these events. She starts naming them like Harold Saxon.
And
the doctor recognizes all of them except she mentions that we're before the war leader.
Yeah,
and he says what, and then doesn't let her say anymore. And so I suspect that's coming up. I suspect that that could be paid off as soon as the next two-parter involving the Zygons on 21st century Earth.
Interesting. Yeah. But anyway, it's good to know that people actually do pay attention to our discussions. And
hey, who knew?
We thought you were all asleep.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, the doctor here is playing his divine self when he is tells Ashildir or Lady Me that humans need shared experiences. It's not right for you to be alone, evoking kind of Genesis here. It's not right for a man to be alone. Here's the opposite. She feels totally fine, apparently, or she is saving this for some other day. The other immortality chip or whatever it is.
Okay, and therein lies another questionable bit of writing because he's given her this chip. Obviously, it's meant to be paid off.
Yep.
And he says, why haven't you used it for anybody? And she says, no one's been worthy. Really? Even her three
children? That's
when
what
they
I
were
thought
dying
too.
Of the plague?
Yeah.
I mean, obviously you can't give the chip to all of them, but you might give it to the last one who's surviving. Presumably they didn't all die at the same moment.
Yeah,
and so she could have kept one child alive.
I don't know. It's convenient for the story, but it doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
I can't
think of a rationalization around that. I mean, she could have gone to sleep for the night and found all three dead in the morning, but
but even then, I mean, she was already dead when she got the chip. So,
true.
She could have tried.
Yeah.
Oh well. Perhaps the three died at the same time, and she didn't know what to choose, so she kind of was. I don't know. We don't have to solve the writing problem here, but it did feel a little bit.
As long as we acknowledge the writing problem.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Yes. Yes. And then we get the whole exchange between this rogue Han Solo type of guy and the doctor. And the doctor, no puns. I'm against banter. And then he continues to make a lot of puns himself, which returns at the end of the episode where you have the whole exchange, like the stand-up routine when they're witnessing the hanging.
Delaying the execution.
Had some good jokes. Life is short, but lives do matter. That was another quote that I wrote down. Because I think it's true. I mean, it doesn't matter how short your life is, but it does matter. It's not the length of life, nor even the quality of life that defines life, I think.
Which is a different contrast for what she thinks, because she thinks, oh, they just vanish like smoke.
Yeah. Well, that's...
They're no more consequential than smoke.
And that's why she doesn't care anymore. And that's why she's so easy to kill other people. And the doctor is shocked because it might have been a temptation that he has felt himself. You know, since what use is it to save mankind if all they do is dying in the end anyway, and you're the only one left? You know, he could have stepped away, but he doesn't because he cares. And he feels, again, this was kind of the Luke Skywalker Darth Vader moment, like, where is the inner you? Is it still there? The doctor believes that there's still good in her, and she has lost that hope or belief. But in the end, of course, she's still there. Let's see what else was in this episode. Well, we got the whole Delta Leonis thing. The amulet was his means of travel. The underworld is another dimension. So the Greeks were just basically their mythology is just based on alien dimensions or something like that.
Intervention,
yeah.
Who mourns for Adonis?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like this one thing that I think it's the doctor who says that every death is a fracture in reality, and you can try to pry it open. But I thought it was actually that was profound. Like, a death is a fracture in reality. It's something that's not supposed to be, but it's a crack.
Yeah. It's something that at least hints beyond the atheistic materialistic worldview, because if we're just bags of meat, and then one death is not a fracture in reality. And so it suggests a transcendent value that goes beyond the merely material to human life.
Well, and that quest for transcendence is very strong in this episode and in Ashildir's quest for something more, you know, just extending life, immortality on this planet, in this human condition, is not enough. It's not fulfilling. You stop caring. And so she wants to escape to another dimension, literally. I'm thinking this is a perfect metaphor. You could use this episode to explain eternal life and why it's fundamentally different from an extended life here on Earth. Because it's this – You got to go beyond what is fulfilling in this life to be truly happy for eternity. So I don't know. It's not that much perhaps that's why Stephen Moffat wanted to rewrite this episode, because it's too religious. I don't know.
Actually, that was the one that he rewrote enough to get a writing credit was the previous one.
Oh,
this
okay.
one was written – only has one writer credited. I forget her name. I did read it pointed out that this is the first episode in years that has been credited exclusively to a woman.
Yeah, it's Catherine Tregenna.
Yeah,
Tregenna.
Which I thought was interesting, but I don't really care about the gender of the writer as long as they tell me a good story.
Sure.
So
exactly.
The doctor knows what's going to happen if you create a portal, and you know, I'm like every gamer knows this. If you open portal, I'm a fan of the Elder Scrolls and that whole mythology of those games, and yeah, if you open a portal, it's not to leave this Earth. It's for other bad guys and monsters to step in. It's always a bad idea to open portals to whatever dimension there is. And that's exactly what's going to happen. We don't really see that much. We see just some lights. It was a pretty cheap special effect. It reminded me of the first Avengers movie. Remember with the portal, and then but then the aliens actually come through. Here they just seem to be stuck there, and for some reason they just shoot.
It says that they're on their way, and they're just firing ahead of them because you can see the planet in the background and everything, and they're spaceships that are apparently are taking their sweet time getting there. But
apparently,
yeah, which is awfully convenient. There's another awfully convenient bit of writing here. I saw it coming that the way to stop the portal is to give the other immortality chip to the guy that's dying. Mm-hmm. So that's fine.
Yeah.
But what I didn't like was then the Lion Man says, "Oh no, if you close the portal, my brothers will all kill me. Have mercy on me." Ah, and they kill him. And it's like, okay, this is simply so we don't have to deal with the Lion Man after the portal closes. Exactly. This comes out of nowhere. It is not set up properly. It's just sloppy writing.
It was. And really talk about a one-dimensional character. We never hear about his story or background or motivations. He's just someone who looks like the Beast from Belle and the Beast. And, well, they probably paid too much for the makeup job, and then they just didn't have money left to write something for him. Anyway, yeah, it was late, sloppy writing. But then they had some good one-liners for the jokes, you know, like the, "I'm an undercover constable of Scotland Yard." Wait, do you have already Scotland Yard? Is that around already?
Yeah.
No, of course not. And
I thought we're, and I don't want to be too down on this episode, but the thing that I thought was really redemptive for the episode in terms of the writing is the conversation the doctor has with Ashildur at the end when they're in the tavern.
Yeah.
And he explains why he can't take her with him. And I thought that just that just covered over a multitude of writing sense.
Yes.
That conversation crystallized the theme of the episode in a way that made an actual valuable contribution to Doctor Who mythology of why he has companions, where he is in his journey with respect to having companions.
If you would summarize it, what would be this contribution
to the mythology? Off screen, we need the Doctor to have companions for storytelling purposes, but we need a reason for this being who's traveling the universe to have and who's immortal, to have these temporary companions who are not immortal. And that's always been a big puzzle. Why does the Doctor have these companions? And they raise the question on the show repeatedly, and they let it play into the Doctor's angst about having these people he's known, and then he leaves them behind, or they die, or he's sad afterwards. He went into a huge funk after Amy and Rory left the show, which felt natural given the relationships he had with them. But then he still needs to get new companions. He can't just wander by himself. And this episode put a bow on that and said, where he says, we need the Mayflies.
Yes.
As immortal beings, we need people around us who are short-lived to help us retain that perspective and see the universe through the eyes of people who are not immortal and not as old and jaded as we are, so that we still recognize the value of things, even though they're transient from our perspective.
You know, that kind of plays in, actually, I'm looking at the chat room on the YouTube site, and Dom actually popped in. He wasn't able to join us for the show, but he popped in. He says, the reason why she didn't give the second chip to someone is maybe by that time she was thoroughly disgusted by her immortality and didn't want to curse someone else with it because she was not reminded by those who were more transitional, if you will, in their lives of the beauty of life, of, you know, the things that the doctor needs the companions to help him see.
Interesting theory. They could have said that on the show.
Yeah.
And it would have been a better answer than no one was worthy.
Mm-hmm.
I like Dom's answer better.
Yeah,
exactly.
Dom, you gotta send Moffat your email address if they want to do rewrites. Get involved. But I really love that whole analogy with the Mayflies. They know how precious life is because it is fleeting. I think that's very true and very profound. And so mortality, even though it is a crack in reality. And this is actually a big theological discussion as well. Does death belong in the original plan of God? Was there meant to be a transition between creation and then heaven? Or is it something and is it just the kind of the negative aspects of death, the pain, the suffering that are a result of Adam and Eve's betrayal? Or is it death itself? But I like this approach of, like, the fact that we are finite beings helps us estimate, value the gift of life, or this life, even more. I think it's true. I've seen it with, you know, in my pastoral work as a priest, and you must have the same experience, Father Corey, that you meet people that the moment that they hear that they are
terminally ill, mm-hmm. everything changes. Every single moment in their life gets weight, gets importance, exactly. is valued, and you treasure the simplest things, like a cup of tea in the morning. And that's even, what they
even,
teach us.
Even when it's not even terminal, but it's something very serious.
Yeah, yeah.
That could potentially become terminal. You know, we start to really think about what we're doing a little bit more clearly. Mm-hmm.
So that brings us to the end of this. Oh, there was one thing. The doctor mentions to Shilder that he has once traveled with another immortal. And he mentions Captain Jack Harkness, and I'd forgotten about him because I didn't really care for his character. But why didn't he continue to travel with the Doctor? Was that he just didn't want to? Or
he was never really a full-time companion. He traveled on a few episodes here and there, but he was really a segue into the Torchwood series.
Right, right.
So that's why he was never really a regular companion. When he first said that line, I thought he was referring to Romana, because and actually, for that matter, he could have been referring to Susan. because he's traveled with two other Time Lords who are thus both as immortal as he is.
Yeah.
You know, and to be fair, you know, with Captain Jack's character, at least at first he wasn't immortal. It was when the whole thing with the Daleks and Rose absorbing the time stream and all that stuff, and but then became that, and he kind of went off on his own direction. And like you said, Jimmy, it was so that they could get Torchwood launched. Mm-hmm.
All right, we'll see what will happen to the character of Ashildir, if she returns, when she returns. And, of course, I'm also curious to know what will happen to Clara, because Clara was totally absent from this episode. She only shows up at the very, very end, and it's like, did you miss me? And the Doctor acknowledges, yes, I missed you. And then he has that look. It's like, tum, tum, tum. That is definitely,
check out the selfie.
This is the look that goes into the trailer for the goodbye episode. Which do
incidentally,
go ahead.
Well, speaking of returns, we have an interesting return coming up next episode, which is going to be Osgood.
Mm-hmm.
The Doctor fan that Missy apparently killed last season.
Yeah. I noticed in the trailer as well, and we also get reminded of this. Other actress that was in the selfie, was it? She also played in one of those previous seasons, I suppose.
Well,
or not.
In the selfie, you saw Ashildir in the background.
In the background,
right?
But that was kind of interesting. To like the Doctor looks like he's concerned, and I didn't really get why.
She said that she was going to protect the planet from the Doctor.
Well, and also that she was going to take care of the Doctor's leftovers and look after the, I guess, the Mayflies that. We're no longer traveling with him or something. So I took that to mean that she was going to follow up and make sure his companions were okay after he had moved on from.
Makes sense. Yeah, makes sense. Then she has a lot of work to do.
And so she then shows up in the background, you know, making sure Clara's okay or something like that.
Yeah, probably. All right. Well, where can people find you online, Father Corey?
Well, probably the easiest is on Facebook, Twitter, and all that kind of good stuff at Fr. Corey Stika. I've also got my website, frcorey.org. I usually just post my homilies, my mass homilies there, but I plan to do stuff there eventually.
Very good. And Jimmy, what about you?
People can visit Catholic.com, where they can connect with my work at Catholic Answers, and they can also go to my own blog, JimmyAiken.com.
Excellent. And you can find my podcast over at sqpn.com. I do three shows every week, The Break, The Walk, and Geek Week. And I have a YouTube channel. I'm going to move to a new YouTube channel. And I almost sound like that character from The Simpsons. You might know me from that video, that reaction video to the first Star Wars. Yeah. Star Wars trailer. And, well, I've recorded a second one, which will be posted on that new YouTube channel. And as soon as we have the link, we'll put that in the show notes as well. And I also have a video that I filmed during the Back to the Future marathon. So if you want to see what a Back to the Future marathon with a real DeLorean looks like in the Netherlands, you might want to check out that link. So that's all coming up on the website, sqpn.com/Doctor Who. Take care, see you next time, and thanks for listening.
When will I see you again?
Soon, I expect. Or later. One of those.